All right, good morning. Good morning. Today we are back in Galatians. And once again, if you felt like this sounds dense, that's because it is. This is one of the densest passages in the New Testament. And we're going to have fun with it. We're going to try to unpack it and to describe it so that we know why we read it and what it means to us. Okay. Now, just a reminder, this letter as a whole, this was written by Paul to teach people how to distinguish between the right and the wrong gospel. And in this very center section that we're looking at, Paul is giving a lesson of what the real gospel is. So by explaining what the real gospel is, he's explaining why the false teachings are wrong. And so today it's going to be part two of Gospel 101. Last week was part one. It's probably 501 if you really want to dive deep into it, right? So, but in any case, the false teachers, they said, gospel is Jesus plus the Mosaic Law. You must believe in Jesus and then obey everything in the law. That's how you get saved. But Paul's like, no, the law belongs to the past, right? We believe in Jesus and that's it. Well, for us Christians today, we might think that, well, why? That's kind of the debate in the past. Why should we care about this debate? Well, here's the thing. The law of Moses that they're talking about, that's like over here in our Bible, okay? So that's what we're dealing with. That's the beginning of our biblical story. So if we don't understand what it means, how it functions, and how it relates to the later part of the Bible, then we're missing a big part of the storyline. You know, many people open up the Bible and say, let me figure out this Christianity thing. So they open up the Bible, they think that, oh, I'll start from the beginning. And they read something that sounds outdated and odd to them, and they're like, well, this is not for me. Well, but then the problem is actually that people fail to understand how the law relates to the gospel. And that lack of understanding creates all sorts of misunderstandings and just, in general, missing Jesus. Okay, so again, the big question we're trying to figure it out today and what Paul is addressing in this passage is really how the law of Moses relates to the later gospels. And if you weren't here last week, I'm sorry. But we covered a lot of things. But last week, we explained that this gospel message came here to humanity as a promise. That's the key part you need to remember. It came here as a promise. God promised all sorts of people that people can one day be blessed by him through Abraham and his offspring. Okay, so that's the totality of the promise. One day, people can be blessed. All sorts of people can be blessed by God through Abraham and his offspring. And when we believe in this promise, like Abraham did, when we just believe, when we trust him, and when we take his words for it, and we're justified. We've got it. We have been declared to be eligible to receive that promised inheritance. Okay, so we obtain it by believing instead of working to achieve any status. So that's the promise. Now, so if that's the case, if everything can be accomplished by the promise, then the question we're addressing today is, why then give the law later? Why bother with the law? If the law is not necessary for justification, why did God first give it? And then why should anybody care about it? And what's the use of it? All those questions. That's what we're getting in today. Now, so in this section, to help explain this dynamics between the law and the promise, Paul is adding a new layer to the gospel story that he's in the middle of. He's introducing another theme, the theme of sonship. Okay, that's the main topic today. He's introducing the theme of sonship to describe this gospel story for us. And with this new theme, he's going to explain that the law was given by the Father in order to push people to focus on the promise, so that when the promise becomes available, people will not miss it. We're going to get into it bit by bit, okay? But I'm going to give you, I just gave you the answer up front, and then we're going to get there bit by bit now. Okay, so let's first start with the idea of sonship. Sonship. Remember what we said that what God blessed people? He blessed people that people will be, well, he promised people, sorry. He promised people that people will be blessed by him, and he later described that blessing as receiving an inheritance. And only the people with a right relationship with him get to receive that inheritance. And in later biblical narratives, that right relationship is described as a father-son relationship. Okay, so that means the right relationship that the Bible is describing between God and man is not just a good relationship between a boss and an employee. It's not a good relationship between business partners. It's father and son. That's what's being promised. And it makes sense, right? If you're a son of the father, then you inherit whatever the father owns, right? That's why the inheritance language was revealed early on. Now, so let's pull back a little bit. So think about this, all right? The gospel message that we Christians talk about, it's really about the God of the universe planning to adopt us as his children and giving us his wealth as our inheritance. Right? That's what we're dealing with when we come to church. Okay, that's the message that we're proclaiming. That's the message we're receiving. And that's glorious, if you really think about it, right? We humans, all we know in this world is hard labor, curses, and death, right? We live like slaves under the uncontrollable forces in the world, just scraping by. But if we're adopted by the ruler of the universe, right? Think about the security, the luxury, the love, and the peace we get to enjoy in his world. All right, so that's the Christian gospel we're talking about. And this is the sort of promise that Abraham received about 4,000 years ago. And he understood what this promise meant. And this promise would have brightened his eyes. And even better, this promise, back in the story in Genesis, this promise came with an added layer of assurance. Okay, so we're going to get into the story a little bit, and you'll see why this good news was an even better news. Right. See, last week we saw that when Abraham received this promise, he heard it, and then he believed it, and God counted him as righteous. Right? So he believed it in his heart, and God's like, you're righteous. So that's already good news. But he still felt a little iffy about it, right? He still felt a little, are you for real? Two verses later, this is what he said. He said to God, oh Lord God, I know you've called me righteous. How am I to know that I shall possess it, the inheritance? Right? So Abraham was a little doubtful. I mean, he believed in it. He put his life on it. But in his heart, he's a little, could you give me a little more just for assurance sake? Okay. And then this is what God did. God said to him, bring me a bunch of animals. And Abraham brought all those animals and cut them in half and laid each half over against one another. Okay. So what's happening here? See, back in the days, when two parties wanted to establish a covenant with one another, this is the ritual that they would perform. They would cut animals in half and line the carcasses up to create a pathway. And both parties would walk through the pathway. By doing so, they were declaring that, hey, if I were to break this covenant, may I be cursed and my body be broken like those animals. So that's how they were swearing on their lives that they would keep this covenant. So this is a covenant ritual that they used to have. And this is where we got our wedding ceremonies, by the way. All right, why people sit on the two halves and then both people walk down it. So just so you know, next time you see anybody getting married, you're calling your friends and families dead animals. All right, so that's where we get this imagery. Okay, now, but when they were about to perform the ritual, God put Abraham into a deep sleep. He put him under. And then a smoking fire pot and flaming torch, those things represent the presence of God. Those fire torches pass through between those pieces. Okay, so that's weird, right? Because both parties were supposed to walk through the pieces to swear on their lives. But here, God put Abraham to sleep, and he alone passed through the carcasses. So what does that mean? Right. It means that God alone is responsible for making this covenant work. Right. Whichever party breaks this covenant, God alone would be cursed. So this was God saying to Abraham with this ritual, my promise to you is as sure as I am alive. It's not dependent on you at all. All right, it's dependent on me. I alone would make it work. I would give my life to make it work for you. So again, that's the Christian gospel promise we have. The promise that people from all nations can one day become children of God and receive his inheritance, that promise is as sure as God's life. God swore on his life to promise you that you can become a child of his. Right, so it sounds too good to be true, but then that's the promise we have. And then you really feel the force of the question. Why then give the law, right? Like, the law seems like a letdown. It sounds cold. Everything sounds so bubbly up there, right? It's so great. Why then give the law? Because what the law says is that God is saying to his people, okay, I call you my sons now, but for you to continue to be my son, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, and you must not do this and this and this. And you must do everything perfectly. Otherwise, forget about that sonship. All right, you're out. Out you go. That's what the law says, and that also came from God. And then God made another covenant with Israel according to this law. And this time, Israel, well, if you read the story, Israel, they were standing on two sides of the valley, and they were proclaiming blessings and curses. So that, again, is like the wedding ceremony thing, right? Two sides, and then Israel, they were awake for it, meaning that if Israel fails to obey this law, this covenant, they are to bear the curses themselves. They were awake for it. So it's not like the covenant according to the promise, where only God is liable. So this covenant of the law over here seems worse than the previous one. And if you look at verse 20 in chapter 3, that's what it's talking about. All right, verse 20 is always a really mysterious verse, but that's the key to understand this passage here. Now, verse 20, notice it's saying intermediary and things like that, right? If there's an intermediary, then it means, if there's a mediator, then it means that there are two parties, but God is one. Right, the promise was established by God alone. That's what it means. That's what the verse is referring to. Right? The covenant of the law is not as sure a covenant as the promise. The promise depends on God alone, but this covenant of the law is dependent on people's obedience to the law, and it can be broken. It's shaky. And boy, did Israel break it. Right? So, Once again, why give the law? The promise works great. It's a sure shot. If God wants to bless people, why mess things up by giving this inferior covenant of the law? Like, how did that help anybody? And to be honest, it feels like God was setting people up for failure. Right? Why would he ever do that if he was all for people? Well, verse 19, the first verse of our passage, here's the answer. The answer is the law was added because of transgressions. All right. The law was given because of people's sin. Now, here's the reality. Okay. The reality is the promise of sonship, this promise, it's a great promise. It's a wonderful promise. And in some sense, it's too great a promise. It's too good of a promise for people because that promised sonship was given to sinners, people who were unfit to be God's children. God was so generous, giving this wonderful thing to people, but then those people, they're unworthy to receive it, and that's a problem. So the analogy Paul's using is like this. It's like an honorable and wealthy man promised to adopt a bunch of orphans, and the orphans are us. Okay? He swore on his life that he would adopt those orphans. However, those kids, they are not just orphans. They are rebellious rascals who are unfit to live in the household of the father. So, yes, their sonship has been promised, but in reality, they are in no place to receive it. And this gap in worthiness needs to somehow be addressed before this promise could be fulfilled. So that's the gospel story, and that's a big part of it. So the Father gave them a law to point out and define this gap in worthiness. So this law describes what a true son of the Father should look like. This is how a son would behave in the household of God. And in Paul's analogy, the law is personified. The law is like a guardian or a household manager assigned by the father. So the guardian teaches the children what they must do and must not do in the household of the father. And he's not a very pleasant person to be around. Right? He's treating the kids not yet as true sons because they are really not. Right? He's treating the kids more like slaves. And he communicates in low-level terms, using elementary principles, you know, basic stuff. Don't jump on the sofa, you know, don't drink that water, things like that. And just constantly pointing out where and how those orphans don't measure up to the father's standards. That's what the law is doing. And this guardianship was never meant to be a permanent thing. At some point, the father would confer that sonship to those orphans. So one way or another, these children must close that gap of worthiness before that day comes. But then how? Right? How are they supposed to close that gap of worthiness? What we've learned in the long history of Israel is that those kids won't become sonship worthy under the guardian ever. Right? Because they failed again and again and again and again, and they failed miserably. If the law could talk as a guardian, the guardian would have come to the father and said, "Man, I've tried. All right, master, these children you promised to adopt, they're hopeless. All right, I've done all that I can to teach them, but they just keep breaking your rules. I've disciplined them harder and harder and harder, and they never learned a lesson. They're so bad that I had no choice to drive them away, according to your will, by the way." Right? So they're done. They're out. They're out of your household. They need to be punished. That's what the law says, and the law was right. So now what? Those who are promised adoption are driven away. So what would the father say? What would the father do at this point? You know, he must honor this covenant of the law. And he would say to the guardian, "Yes, you're right. They've broken our covenant according to the law. They're rightly cast out and punished. But don't forget, right? I made another covenant with them earlier, a covenant of my promise. I've sworn on my life to keep that covenant. So I won't sit here and just watch them get cast out. All right? I'll give my life to get them back to receive the promised sonship. That's what I promised. So I'm going to do that. And he did. So the father sent his one and only son to rescue those wayward adoptees. And this son, his son, was already enjoying full legal standing in the home. But he willingly put himself under the guardianship. And this son did everything perfectly under the guardian because, of course, he's already a proper son, right? So that was not something too difficult for him. Right? But he willingly take the punishment by the guardian. He sacrificed his own body, letting it be broken, like the animals cut in half. And why did he do that? He did that so that those wayward adoptees could be rescued, right? He bore the punishments for his younger siblings. And this is what we talked about last week, right? This perfect son offered legal union to those orphans so that through the union, they get to have the curses absorbed by Jesus, and the worthiness of Jesus gets to be counted on those orphans. And they get to live again to receive the Father's promise. So now the promise can work again. Because before, the promise could not work because those people who are supposed to receive the promise, they are dead. So the covenant of the promise is lost. But the Father promised that he would give his life to make it work, so he did. He sent his son, and God broke his son so that his promise could once again work. And he planned to do that all along. He already planned to do that when he established that covenant with Abraham, when he put Abraham under. He planned that all along. He knew that those adoptees, those people from the nations, they were unfit to be his children. And no amount of training could change that. He knew that only his son, his only begotten son, is worthy to be his heir. And the only way for those adoptees to receive the promised sonship is for them to be united with the proper son in identity. That's the only way. And he planned that all along. And that's why he gave the law. He gave the law not to provide a moral ladder for people to climb high enough to be eligible for sonship, right? No, nobody can do that. Rather, the law was given to point out our unworthiness and our inability to try hard enough to become worthy. Right. God gave the law to imprison us under sin, to expose us, to corner us, and to leave us with only one viable option, which is to rely on Christ. So think of the imagery. The law prods us like cattle, or the law traps us like sheepdogs, so that when our big brother Jesus comes out to rescue us, we wouldn't miss him. Okay. So again, the law helps us realize that the only way for us to become a child of God is by putting on Jesus. That's the imagery in Galatians, putting on Jesus. And that's precisely what baptism means. Baptism. Baptism is us declaring that, yes, I believe in Jesus. I believe he's my big brother who's come to rescue me, and I want his help. I want to be united with him by dying with him and living in him. And as we put on Christ, we become children of God because the only worthy son is living inside of us. So we look like a worthy son. And with that son living in us, God sent his spirit in us, so that we don't just look like Christ in the legal sense, but we are becoming like Christ in the real sense by the power of his spirit. All right? Our waywardness is being overcome by the power of the Spirit so that we are becoming more and more fit as the children of God. That's how we truly become children of God, is by the power of the Spirit. So what about the law? Right? What about the guardian? Right? See, we must notice this. The guardian didn't teach anything contrary to the Father. Right? It was established by the Father. It was teaching everything according to the Father's will. But that was for immature children. Right? Things were in elementary terms. It was highly contextual for those children in those days. But once we receive Jesus and become true children of God, once that Spirit has dwelt in us, and we are we basically got a new operating system in us, then we're no longer under the guardian's roster. All right? We are freed from living like a slave. And the Spirit of Jesus takes over to shape us into the children of God. And in Galatians, it says, through the Spirit of Jesus, we finally get to call the God of the universe, Abba, Father. Right? Abba, Father, it's in Greek, it's like, well, in Aramaic, it's like the intimate way you would call your father. Right? So in our modern day, it's probably like your dad, you know, something like that. And we get to call the creator of the universe our dad. We don't just call him God. We don't just call him a creator. We don't just call him a judge. We get to be intimate with the person who created everything. And that's the Christian gospel we believe in, right? We get to be God's children in the real sense, in an intimate way, by believing in Jesus and becoming united with him. And that's the only way. And the law taught us to pick that way instead of trying hard. And that's what communion means as we proclaim our faith in Jesus. Now, we're going to take communion soon. And if you did not get it, get the elements, you could pick one in the back. Now, the thing with the communion is this is representing how we are saved. I mean, I keep talking about the packaging, but it's okay. Yeah, the act of receiving, of eating and drinking, that's how we're saved. It's not going out to do anything to build your credit. It is simply by receiving, and that's precisely what being united with Christ is. It's not by doing the law, climbing a ladder, and try to reach a certain status. If that were the case, then Christianity would look a lot different. But Christianity is all about receiving. I don't have it, I need it, and you give it to me, I'll take it. So communion is a physical and bodily expression of our union with Christ. And the bread, well, in the real way that Jesus did it is that he broke the bread in front of people. And that represents his body being cut in half and the Father walking through it. All right, so when we take the bread, we're saying Jesus broke his body so that I don't need to be broken, so that I can live. And Jesus shed his blood so that I don't need to die. I get to be clean and be eligible to become a son to the Father. And I didn't do any of this. I didn't get broken. I didn't bleed. The only thing I do is receive. So I eat, I drink. Now, let me ask you this, okay? When you stand before God and you feel unworthy, what do you instinctively reach for? Just imagine that you're standing before God, and we must feel unworthy because we're unworthy sinners. Like, what do you instinctively reach for to kind of cover yourselves? Like, is it like your effort, your improvement in moral standings? Is it like your sincerity or your accolades, how much you've done at church? If those things are the things that you reach for instinctively to try to cover yourself, to make yourself look worthy, then that's precisely what the law was given to shut out. Because the point of the law was to force you to not rely on those things that you did, because those things are never going to be enough. What the law was forcing you to do is to find security and peace in Jesus, and just to receive it and have this be your shield and be like, I'm hiding in Jesus. That's how I am worthy. That's what we're doing when we eat the bread and drink this cup. And another important aspect of receiving a communion that we didn't get to talk about a lot in the Galatians part is, as we enjoy our sonship in Jesus, let's remember that the brothers and sisters around me are equally children of God with me, not because we worked equally hard to get here. It's because we all depended on Jesus to get here. So if that's the case, there should be no Jew or Greek. There should be no Chinese or Taiwanese. There should be no male or female, rich or poor, young or old, educated or unlearned. Because all those measurements don't work at all when it comes to becoming children of God. And now we're all children of God only because of Jesus, only because we received something we didn't earn. Then we're equal, and we ought to love everybody in the same way as how Jesus loved all of his siblings, and that is by dying for them. That's what communion reminds us of. So let's get our elements ready. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he broke bread in front of his disciples, again symbolizing what Jesus did for us, what God did with Abraham during that ritual. And he says, this is my body broken for you. Take this and do this in remembrance of me. So let's eat this bread and celebrate what Jesus did for us to give us life. And in the same way, after supper, Jesus took the cup and said, this cup is the new covenant that I made for you. It's a new covenant. So now it makes a little more sense for us, right? This covenant of the law, Israel broke. This covenant of promise, this is what Jesus renewed. He enacted this old covenant of the promise. Israel broke this. This doesn't work. But for this to work, Jesus now enacted that covenant with his blood. And in that sense, this is a new covenant to make that promise work for you. So let's drink the blood of Jesus to receive that promised sonship. Let's stand. And let's confess what we're confessing by taking these elements. Let's read. Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. Father, thank you for this passage. Thank you for these imageries to help us understand the promise you have given us. Thank you for giving us Jesus to be broken for us so that we, these wayward adoptees, get to become your children. Help us remember that there's no way that we could work hard enough to make ourselves worthy to be your children. That's belittling your household, honestly. Help us only depend on Jesus and to be happy and comfortable in it. To know our unworthiness, but to also enjoy our worthiness because of Jesus. Help us constantly stand firm in this posture of receiving your grace, receiving your blessing, and protect us from ever depending on anything that is in us. Because all things come from you anyway. Help us stand firm in this grace as a church so that we can treat one another with grace and mercy instead of judging people according to worldly standards. Help us treat one another as how Jesus treated each one of us by dying for us. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.